I'm here to welcome you to tonight's event. I'm so glad that many of you came out to hear Dr. Robert Sadloff, who is the director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It's a real thrill for me because I've read a lot of his stuff and haven't had the opportunity to meet him before. Dr. Sadloff is the author of many books and monographs. He's an expert on Middle East affairs and U.S.-Israel relations. He appears on radio shows and television shows very often, and he has his own television show, on Al Hura, which is the Arabic satellite television show, and his program is called Dahil Washington, which means Inside Washington, and he's the only non-Arab to host a program on the Arabic satellite television station, so that's a great honor. He's here today. He's going to talk about his most recent book, Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Reach into Arab Lands. And he's going to tell us about his quest to find an Arab Oscar Schindler or Ahmud Wallenberg, and his story, from what I've read about the book, is very interesting. He searched really far and wide, and I'm not sure what he came up with. He'll tell us about that. All of us are here today because we care so much about Israel and our brothers and sisters in Israel, the Jewish homeland. And if you, all of you should know what the Israel and Overseas Center does and what the Middle East Forum does. You should not only know about it, you should be involved, be members, and be active. It is your responsibility as Jews to do that. There is some information out in the hallway on that table. Please pick up the literature and become active if you are not already. In addition to Dr. Sadloff, we also have the pleasure of having our own Philadelphia jewel, Dr. Daniel Pipes. Dr. Pipes is the director of the Middle East Forum, which is a nonprofit organization he started in 1994. Dr. Pipes is one of the foremost analysts on Israel, Islam, and the Middle East. And he is a prize-winning columnist for the New York Sun and the Jerusalem Post, and he formerly served as a member of the presidentially appointed board of the United States Institute of Peace. And as testament to his great influence in the world, he was severely attacked and people tried to prevent him from being appointed to that position. So someone with enemies like that are just a friend of ours. So, Dr. Sadloff, please come and speak and tell us about your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be in Philadelphia tonight. I just had one of those unique moments when one is not a native of the town, and I was waiting in front of a sort of an empty office building on the far side of town for a taxi cab. A taxi finally showed up. I gave the guy the address of where I'm coming to, and he says, "I hope you know where you're going, because this is my first time ever being a taxi driver." So, you know, in good Middle East tradition, the blind leading the blind, we eventually showed up, and I'm delighted that I'm here. It's a real pleasure to be at a forum with my friend Dan Pipes. Daniel has the unique distinction of teaching me almost everything I know about the Middle East. He was an instructor of mine way back when I was taller. He had less gray hair. In graduate school, the Middle East has beaten me down over the years. And it's really, you do have a true jewel in having Daniel here in Philadelphia. I'm also very happy that I can speak in front of a member of my family, Bernie Dagenet, who's the editor of the Philadelphia Business Journal. And I'm sure all the news will get back to the rest of my family how well I do. So whether you like my speech or not, please applaud loudly. Look, it is greatly, you know, it's one of the great tragedies of our day that 60-some-odd years after the end of World War II, the head of state of a sovereign nation that has a history that goes back thousands of years, a sovereign nation, one of whose earliest leaders was himself a great friend of the Jewish people, Cyrus, someone that people have called perhaps the first Zionist for sending the Jews back to the land of their historic homeland, thousands of years ago, that the president of this sovereign nation is convening a conference to determine whether, in fact, the Holocaust ever happened. Holocaust denial is, of course, not the province only of the Ahmadinejads of this world. It is, regrettably, a common feature of Arab and Muslim societies. It really takes one of three forms. First is the traditional denial. It didn't happen. What Ahmadinejad has been saying. He, of course, is Persian. He's not Arab. But his antecedent is deep in Arab political history. It was the president of Egypt in 1964, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the first major head of state who said to all people, a German newspaper, that the Holocaust was a myth and that you'd have to be a fool to believe that 6 million people were exterminated by the Germans. This is traditional denial. It didn't happen. At the far end of the spectrum, at the other side of the spectrum, is something very different. It's what I call Holocaust glorification. Not that it didn't happen, but yes, it happened, and it was good. And the only bad thing about it is that Hitler didn't finish the job. And this is also the province of official statements. If you read, for example, the editorials of a government newspaper in Egypt called El Akhbar, it periodically runs something like this. Oh, Hitler, glory be unto you. We regret only that you did not complete the task. So these are the two far ends of the spectrum, denial on one end and glorification on the other. But after 20 years living and working and traveling in the Middle East, my own personal experience is that neither of these reflect the view of the vast majority of educated people in this part of the world. That for them, what we call denial is really something else. It's really what I would call Holocaust minimization or Holocaust trivialization. Sure, this mindset goes, sure, bad things happen to the Jewish people. Sure, war is hell. Sure, many people died. We don't really quite know how many. And so you get, for example, the president of Syria telling Charlie Rose just a few months ago, I don't really know how many people died in the Holocaust and it really doesn't matter. Or you get the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, writing a dissertation for which he got a PhD in the Soviet Union 30 years ago, in which which was based on the concept that we don't really know how many Jews died. It's a matter of legitimate dispute. And the whole idea behind minimization or trivializing the Holocaust or making it relative to other tragedies is a political idea. That is, if you deny the uniqueness of the enormity of the Holocaust, you can deny, in the minds of many Middle Easterners, you can deny the special remedy that for many in the Middle East is provided for the Holocaust, which is, of course, Israel. Now, history runs in somewhat of a different direction. Anybody here who knows this history will know that Britain, for example, first suggested to partition Palestine into states, one for the Jewish people and one for Arab people, well before the first Panzer tank rolled into Poland, well before the first Jew was exterminated. This is a very unsettling historical fact for those people who hold the narrative that Israel solely is a product of the Holocaust. But be that as it may, the relationship between the Holocaust and Jews and Arabs is very real and powerful. It first hit me in a personal way on 9/11, when I, like many millions of others, had their 9/11 story. Mine was no worse than most, and actually quite better than most. I was in Manhattan on 9/11, and I saw the plane hitting the North Tower. And later that day, as I was walking down a totally empty Fifth Avenue, it dawned on me that the image of the plume of smoke heading out of the North Tower morphed in my own mind into the chimneys of Auschwitz. It just evolved, this imagery. It hit me that the perpetrators of 9/11 used the greatest technology of the day to kill as many people as quickly and efficiently as possible. was, of course, the formula of Auschwitz. The difference being 9/11 was for a couple of hours, Auschwitz being for years. I should say parenthetically that as I've gone around the country talking about my book the last couple of weeks, so many different Holocaust survivors have come up to me and said, you know, that imagery of 9/11, I had the same reaction too. For some people, it was the ashes that was strewn all over lower Manhattan. For other people, it was the tower. But it dawned on lots of people, and I've been touched by how many people have come and talked to me about that. Anyway, that idea in my mind got me to start to think about the relationship between Arabs and the Holocaust. Not so much the perpetrators, the Muhammad Attas. They would never think about the relationship. It would never dawn on them. But it got me to think about the great cultural divide between Arab and Muslim societies and our own society, of which Holocaust denial is just the tip of the iceberg. In many ways, it manifests, it reflects this great cultural divide. And so I decided soon after 9/11 that my small contribution to fighting the hatred that was manifested on 9/11 would be to combat Holocaust denial in Arab societies. The question was how to do it. Traditionally, there are two ways to teach or talk about the Holocaust to Arabs and Muslims. The first way is to discuss the traditional narrative, Europeans killing European Jews. This is important, and this is essential, but it is totally ineffective. The second way is to recite a litany of the obscure, grotesque, gruesome, insulting things that one can see on Al Jazeera or read on the newspapers in major Arab cities about the Holocaust, and shame Arabs into changing their view, at least those Arabs that are open-minded about this. And this is important, and this is essential work, but my experience is that it's totally ineffective as well. And so I searched for a different way. And it came to me that maybe if there are people of goodwill in Arab societies, the way to touch them is to talk about the Holocaust as an Arab story. And not just an Arab story, but a story about which people could be proud. And I came up with the idea of searching for an Arab hero, an Arab who saved a Jew. For if you accept the idea that there is an Arab who saved a Jew, if an Arab accepts the idea that there was an Arab who saved a Jew during the Holocaust, then you have to accept the context, that there was something to be saved from. And so began a search for Arabs who saved Jews during the Holocaust. Very soon I learned that among the 20,000 righteous of the world, non-Jews, recognized by Yad Vashem for saving Jews, I learned that there were Muslims, Turks, Bosnians, and Albanians. I learned that there's a Chinese, that there's a Japanese, and that there's even a Peruvian. But there's never been an Arab. And this didn't make sense to me, given that the war was fought in Arab lands. And so the first thing I did is I started to learn about the experience of Jews in Arab lands, and only then could I begin to really understand the role that Arabs played. I found that an entire chapter of the history of the Holocaust is often ignored and little known. And this is what happened to Jews in Arab lands, especially the lands of North Africa. Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya. These are lands that were governed by Axis powers, by the French in Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, by the Libyans in Libya, and this included Tunisia, which for 6 months was under German occupation, the only Arab country to suffer a full German occupation. And in these lands, there were 500,000 Jews. And what I learned was that during the time in which the Axis powers were in control, they applied in these countries what I call all the precursors of the final solution, all the elements of the final solution except one, that one being being extermination camps. In these lands were applied anti-Jewish laws governing where people could live, what they could eat, where their children could go to school, what clothes they should wear, what they could do from morning till night. In these lands, there were established more than 100 labor camps, more than 100 slave and forced labor camps. Some of these were for Jews deported from Europe. Terrible stories of thousands of Jews deported from Germany, Austria, Romania, by the Vichy France, to slave labor camps deep in the Sahara Desert. So it was 3 years ago last month that my wife and I and my two kids got into a Land Rover. We were living in Rabat, Morocco. We got into a Land Rover, and we drove 1,500 kilometers east to the border between Morocco and Algeria, and we followed the track of the Trans-Sahara Railway. It's the cover of my book. The Trans-Sahara Railway was a French project to do the impossible, to build a railroad from deep into the of Africa across the Sahara going to France. And they tried to do the impossible with Jewish slave labor. And we followed the train in order to find remnants that no one has ever found before of these labor camps. And I'm delighted to say we found what we were looking for. We found places like Bergent, which is the only all-Jewish slave labor camp that the French ever established. Places like Kendrara, where there are structures still out there in the absolute middle of nowhere, paying testimony to what Jews and others suffered. They called them concentration camps at the time. Indeed, one thing that most people tend to forget is that the first concentration camps liberated by the Allies were concentration camps in Arab lands, liberated by American and British troops in November and December 1942, after Operation Torch, the first American engagement of the war. What people tend to forget was that for 6 months of the war, or certainly from early 1943 to May 1943, the single most important piece of territory in the European theater of war wasn't in Europe at all. It was in Tunisia. Small Arab country. The Allies had invaded in November 42. The Germans responded 2 days later by sending their airplanes and then their soldiers to Tunisia. When Rommel was defeated at El Alamein, his troops went to Tunisia, and there Hitler said, hold this small Arab country at all costs. And for the months, early months of 1943, this is where the war was fought. And during that time, the Germans still sent to Tunisia, the SS, led by some of its most notorious killers, men like Sir Walter Rauch, the inventor of the mobile death gas van in Europe, to implement every aspect of the Final Solution in Tunisia except death camps. Slave labor, deportations, confiscations, executions, the Yellow Star. And the only reason that the Jews of this part of the world did not suffer the fate of the Jews in Europe was time and space. The Allies evicted the Germans from Africa by May of 1943, before the Germans had time to finish the job. And to have sent them to the death camps in Europe would have required boats and airplanes, not just trains. Now, this is what happened to the Jews. What role did Arabs play? Well, my next great finding was Arabs played a role remarkably like that of Europeans in Europe. Remarkably like that of Europeans in Europe. The vast majority of local people, of local Arabs, the vast majority were indifferent to the fate of the Jews. This indifference was of two types. Half of the indifference was, well, we're in the middle of a war, I have to take care of my family, and I can't worry about anybody else. But a part of this indifference was much more malicious. The Jews were getting their comeuppance, and that's not so bad. And I have testimonies reflecting both. Then there was a minority, a regrettably sizable minority, from the highest levels of government down to the lowliest, that participated fully and willingly in the persecution of Jews. There were Arabs who went door to door with SS, pointing out where Jews lived. There were Arabs who served as torturers at the slave labor camps, and I have testimonies of Jews confirming this. There were Arabs at the highest level of governments in complete cahoots with the Nazis and with Vichy. Total participation. And then you have remarkable stories, just like those 20,000 other stories of righteous who saved Jews. You have remarkable stories of Arabs who risked, in some cases, everything, including their lives, to save Jews. These stories are really breathtaking. Some of them are about people whose names we'll never know. There are stories of Arab wet nurses. Jews were on the lowest rung of the ration ladder in French North Africa. First was Europeans, then non-Jews, and then Jews. There are stories of Arab wet nurses who took in Jewish babies because there wasn't enough milk for them to survive. Arab bakers who would put aside extra loaves of bread for Jewish families. Arab shepherds who would give their tents to Jews from bombed out villages. There's a wonderful story in Algiers in 1941. Vichy France wanted to bribe as many Arabs as they could to join them. And they offered any Arab who would participate, they offered them to serve as custodians of confiscated Jewish property. A very lucrative business. Jewish shops, Jewish factories. And then one day in 1941, all the imams of Algiers, all the mosque preachers, issued a khutbah, a mosque speech on the same day, prohibiting the believers from accepting Vichy's offer. The amazing thing is not that they issued that speech, that edict. The amazing thing is that not a single Arab violated the injunction. And there wasn't one Arab who accepted the offer of being a custodian of Jewish property in Algiers. We know about the famous stories of the Sultan of Morocco, who lent important moral support to Jews. And the same and even greater is true of the Bey of Tunis. Tunis was also a principality, a monarchy at the time. We tend not to hear their story because history is written by the victors. And in Tunisia, there was a revolution 11 years after the end of the war, and the royal family has been written out of history. But a few years ago when I was in Tunis and I visited the Grand Rabbi of Tunis, he lived next door in his apartment building to the oldest living heir of the royal family. Now impoverished, he was in his late 80s, he's since passed away. But I knocked on his door and he was very glad to let me in because he was eager, once I explained what I was doing, he was eager to tell me the story of what his family did. And then he said, the best evidence of this is how the Jews have taken care of us. This apartment, he told me, this apartment I live in was paid for by the Jewish community. My children's education was paid for by Jews. My entire life, since the revolution, we've been taken care of by the Jewish community of Tunis. And then there are amazing stories of people whose names we do know. People who really risked everything to save Jews. There's a story of a man by the name of Si Ali Sakat, whose picture is on the back cover of my book. He's a former mayor of Tunis, who retired in the 1920s to a farm that happened to be right on the border between the two warring armies in the Zaghouan Valley, about 30 kilometers west of Tunis. And one day in the heat of battle, 60 Jews who had been interned at an Axis labor camp banged on the door of his farm looking for refuge, and he had to make a decision, let him in or not. That little piece of territory had gone back and forth during the previous round of fighting about half a dozen times. But he decided to let them in, and he saved 60 Jews. And then there's the wonderful story of Khalid Abdul Wahab in a Tunisian seaside town of Mahdia, who learned one night that a German officer was coming to rape a Jewish woman. And he got there first, to the place where that woman and her family and several other families had been hiding in an olive oil press factory. And he banged on their door and said, you have to come with me. And for the rest of the night, he ferried that woman and her family and all the others to a piece of property he owned. And he kept them there for 6 weeks until the war was over. And he saved those Jews. And then even in the heart of Europe, in Paris, right under the eyes of the Germans, there's an amazing story of a man named Si Kador Ben Gabrit, who is probably the most influential Arab in all of Europe. He was the rector, the founder, the imam of the great mosque of Paris. He saved up to 100 Jews in a very ingenious way. He gave gave them certificates of Muslim identity, birth certificates, marriage certificates, certifying that they were really Muslims, not Jews. And with that, they could evade arrest and deportation. In one fantastic story, he even saved a very famous Jewish singer, Simon Halali, by having Halali's grandfather's name inscribed on a tomb, on a gravestone, in the Muslim cemetery outside of Paris. Really brilliant. Now, these stories of both the villains and the heroes, the perpetrators and the rescuers, I believe are very important. They're important to both Arabs and Jews. But yet, we haven't heard these stories before. In the final chapter of my book, I explain why. Why, after 60 years, does it take a historian, not a historian of the Holocaust, and I am not a historian of the Holocaust, why now are we only hearing these stories? And the answer is really twofold. First, the answer is Jews didn't look too hard. And second, Arabs didn't want to be found. Why do I say Jews didn't want to look too hard? Well, first, the whole experience of the Holocaust in Arab lands, very quickly after the end of the war, became bound up in an intra-Jewish tension, really an inter-Jewish conflict, between Sephardim and Ashkenazim in Israel. For obvious reasons, the Holocaust narrative became an Ashkenazi narrative. And as I say in every speech, the Holocaust was overwhelmingly a European phenomenon. But this became a point of great tension between these two groups of immigrants to Israel. And it became a point of division, much more than a point of unity. And I think many people in this room understand what I mean by how Ashkenazim and Sephardim in general have had troubled relationship in Israel, and how the Holocaust itself could be manifested in that difference. It was only last year, actually earlier this year, that Yad Vashem issued its first ever curriculum to teach young Israelis about the experience of Jews in Arab lands. Only in 2006. So Jews, historians in general, did not focus on this story, and they certainly didn't focus on the role that Arabs played. Among Arabs, well, they didn't want to be found. You remember that story of Siali Sakat, the former mayor of Tunis, who saved 60 Jews? Well, in the course of my research, I met two of his grandchildren, one in Paris and one in Tunis, and they both told me the following tale in almost exactly the same words. They both said, you know, it's wonderful what you tell me about my grandfather, because I've never heard this story before. But in our family, we tell a different story about our grandfather's hospitality and generosity, of which we are very proud. You see, at the end of the war, our grandfather did open his farm, not to Jews, but he opened his farm to a group of German infantrymen who were trying to evade capture as prisoners of war. And we cherish that story, which suggests our grandfather opened his farm to people in need. And I can respect that. The only problem is there's not a shred of evidence to suggest that the grandfather actually did open his farm to Germans. And there are testimonies of individual Jews written in the late 40s and early 50s thanking Siali Sakat for opening his farm to Jews. Somewhere over the last 60 years, it became toxic in these societies for that story to be passed down in the right way. And what I hope to do in my book is to detoxify that problem, which is really why I say that these are not the hidden stories. My subtitle is Lost Stories, because these stories were always there if we wanted to look for them. Now, I am quite hopeful about what this book can do, what knowing more about the experience of Arabs and Jews and the era of the Holocaust can do. I'm hopeful that it will open some minds. I'm delighted that next month, of all institutions, the U.S. Department of State is sending me abroad to speak to Arab audiences beginning in could give exactly the same talk that I'm giving to you today, probably in Arabic in some places. I'm delighted that the U.S. Holocaust Museum is translating a large portion of this book and putting it in Arabic, in Farsi, and in Urdu on its website, so that for the first time, speakers of those languages, Arabs and Muslims and Iran and Pakistan, can have special content just for them to understand and access their experience with the Holocaust. You know, I've had some critics, I've had quite a few critics in the Arab world who say, oh, now you're blaming us for the Holocaust too. But that's not what this is all about. I'm delighted that this past week the ambassador of Morocco hosted a reception for me, which is really a sign that things are beginning to change, because it was only 2 years ago that so many different people of authority in Morocco and elsewhere didn't really want to be part of the research. But most of all, I'm delighted with the sort of emails that I'm getting, which run the gamut, but the majority from Arabs run something like this. They say, thank you for telling the story of Arab heroes, but thank you also for telling the story of Arab villains. Thank you for showing that we Arabs had the full range of actions and emotions. Thank you for showing that we're not cardboard cutouts. Thank you for showing that we're not two-dimensional, that we can be good and bad and evil and righteous at the same time, because we have to be responsible for everything that we do. Now, as somebody who is not a romantic about the possibility of making peace between Arabs and Israelis anytime soon, and I don't think peace is around the corner, as someone who is not a romantic about that, I am really encouraged when I read emails from people in Egypt and Iraq and Jordan and Morocco which say, we Arabs need to take responsibility for everything that we do. It's not sufficient to help bring about peace between Arabs and Israelis, but it certainly is necessary. And given everything that's going on in the Middle East these days, I'll take whatever progress that we can get. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob, for really an extraordinary presentation on an extraordinary topic. Commend you for leaving the day-to-day politics of Washington to go off on this venture, and congratulate you on the success of your research effort. He is very much engaged in the day-to-day, as you wouldn't know it from this talk, but very much engaged in the day-to-day of Middle East politics in Washington. This is an extraordinary development. I'm sure there'll be questions about the substance of what you spoke. But let me open it by asking you about an implication of what you spoke. There's a lot of talk these days that Islam is evil. Jihad, bad treatment of women, of minorities, slaves, and the like, has been part of Islam since the 7th century, part of it today. What people like me call radical Islam is just Islam. There is no other sort. And that it is a disease, it's a cult, it's a evil development. One of the ways I argue against that, and specifically to Jewish audience, is by arguing that from the inception of Islam, what's called 622, until 1945, the Jewish experience was markedly better in the Muslim world than the Christian world, as evidenced by the steady flow of Jews from Christendom to Islam. 1945 marked a turning point that had been never the kind of experience the Jews had in the Muslim, in the Christian world, the pogroms, the Holocaust in the Muslim world. And since then, since 1945, a mere 60 years of the post-Christian century, indeed it's been reversed. And the Jewish experience in the Muslim world is considerably worse than the Christian world, and the flow of refugees is in the other direction. Could you comment on that, whether you think that's valid, and how your own research and thinking would, what context you see in it?
Thank you. Yes, I do think what you just articulated is valid. How could I not? I would put it in a slightly different way. First, it is absolutely true that Jews lived, that you, if you were a Jew, you were better off living in a Muslim land than in under Christendom for the last, for much of the last 2,000 years. I mean, at the luck of the draw, you would be better off having been born anywhere from Casablanca on the east to Iran, Casablanca on the west to Iran on the east. I also like to add to this that in objective terms, being a Jew in Muslim lands was not a rose garden. Relative to Christendom, it was a hell of a lot better. For the actual person living in these countries, life could be pretty bad. You were a second-class citizen. You were never burned at the stake. But you did have to pay special taxes, wear special clothes, you were determined what your occupation could be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And oftentimes, you were the most loyal to the monarch because it was the monarch who protected you from the masses. So I think it's important to understand both relatively and objectively the situation of Jews in these countries. I think Daniel is precisely right about Islam. And especially for a Jewish audience, I would imagine that Jewish audiences would understand this more than most. Because my experience is that among the 1.2 billion Muslims, there are about as many varieties of practice of Islam as there are the varieties of Jewish practice among the many fewer Jews in this world. I mean, we Jews in this room, I'm not going to ask you to embarrass yourself, but how many of you here, maybe just once, maybe not that many, but maybe, I know I'm guilty, I have mixed milk and meat just once. Or maybe somebody in here, God forbid, drove in a car on Shabbat. Or the point I'm trying to make is there is a great range of practice in Judaism. The same thing among Muslims. Believe it or not, not all Muslims in this world pray five times a day. Believe it or not, not all Muslims in this world fast throughout the month of Ramadan. Once in a while, one or two Muslims have had a scotch or a glass of wine. You know, these things happen. And we should recognize the breadth of Muslim practice, just like we understand the breadth of Jewish practice. It is really how religions are practiced that is the most important thing, which is not at all to suggest or to minimize the problem of radical Islam. Actually, quite the contrary. It is a big enough problem if, for argument's sake, 10% of all Muslims are adherents to radical Islamism. That's 120 million people who would like to, you know, create a totalitarian global system governed by a strict interpretation of Islamic law and are willing perhaps even to use violence to achieve it. So that's bad enough. We don't have to exaggerate that into 50% of all Muslims, which is not true. I think I would agree both with the sentiment and with how it plays out in our political debate, which I think is very important. Any questions? I think there's no doubt that the traditional Saudi bargain between the Wahhabi school and the Saud family is a key mainstay of this regime. What is most troubling to someone like me is, you know, it'd be bad enough if they did it only in Saudi Arabia, but do they have to do it in Philadelphia and New York and San Francisco and and Virginia. It's when they export the extremism and the radicalism to schools and mosques and institutions around the world that it becomes a true national security problem. Not to belittle what they do domestically, but I think the first order problem that we need to address is getting them to stop the total stop on the export of this extremist ideology through funds and teachers and through school books and other tools. You want to?
Started out telling us the reason why this would be valuable, and in the process of listening to you, I lost those reasons, and I'm really curious if you would tell us why it matters and in what way it will make it better.
Well, there are reasons why are appropriate for Jews, and there are reasons why it's appropriate for Arabs. For Jews, I think it's very important for us not to lose this chapter of the Holocaust. It's important for us to know that in this part of the world, it is not solely defined by the Mufti, that our knowledge of what Arabs did during the darkest moment of our people's history actually has texture to it, content to it, that there were some Arabs who were participants and some Arabs who were rescuers. And we should celebrate the latter, and we should make sure that Arabs learn about the former. I think that we do no service to ourselves when we exempt Arabs from this history. Now, this isn't just a little speech on behalf of tolerance, you know, some nice thing that we do on Sundays. In my view, tolerance education is a national security problem, because not knowing for Arabs not to know about this is the tip of the iceberg, I use that metaphor again, for their exemption from a whole range of histories. Why is Darfur going on? Why are Arabs, why were there such indifference among Arabs to what happened to the Kurds, the gassing of citizens of an Arab country by an Arab head of state? We have such low standards. We have such low standards that I think it's outrageous. Why are they exempted from knowing about this, especially if they played a role in it? I think it is a part of what we need to do to help prevent so many of the disasters that happen in Arab countries, and I think we have to invest in this because it can affect our own national security. So I think there's a reason why we Jews should know this chapter, and there's a reason why we as Americans should know this, because we have been on the receiving end of some of that ignorance.
I'm wondering, to follow up on that question a little bit more, we heard recently from David Gogg, who wrote a book about the evolution of Christianity or even evangelicals and some of the evolution of their theology from, and I forget all the exact terminology, from replacement of, that Christians replaced the Jews and therefore, which led to a lot of anti-Semitism, or that Christian theology replaced Jewish theology, and that therefore that lent itself to anti-Semitism and the fact that that and eventually violence and things like that to a more tolerant view, which has emerged in the last 50 years in the United States, that says okay, there's different faiths and Christians having Christian theology after replaced Jewish theology, but at some point they're going to come together and it's going to be more cooperative. That's not a great way to put it, but you get the point. So is there, in your research, did you find anything in Muslim thinking that you would say if this strain of Muslim thought were to become more of a majority strain, that we would have a different type of relationship with the Muslim community?
Let me tell you a little story instead of giving a theological answer. One of my closest friends in Morocco is this liberal, democratic, open-minded, Western-educated Moroccan woman who spent a lot of time with my family, went to synagogue with us back in America one time, a very tolerant person. So we're talking one day about Middle East politics, and she says to me, she says, you know, I think there should be two states, one for the Israelis and one for the Palestinians. I buy all that. It's just Zionists that I hate. So this made me think for a minute, because when I grew up, Zionism was the ideology of Jewish nationalism, the search for the creation of a Jewish state in the traditional homeland of the Jewish people. And so I asked her, I said, well, I don't understand. What do you mean? And he said, no, it's two states. It's just I hate Zionists. Well, what is your definition of Zionist? And she said to me something which I think was, for me, an eye-opener and quite revealing. She said, when I was brought up, a Zionist, Zionism means the purposeful infliction of pain and suffering on Muslims. It has nothing to do. It had nothing to do with Israel. It was the purpose that she learned when she went to a little mosque school when she grew up, that Zionism, the meaning of it, was the purposeful infliction of pain and suffering on Muslims. And to be a Zionist was somebody who did bad things to Muslims. Now, with that definition in her mind, it made perfect sense, her political beliefs. Now, someone like her is the perfect target for my book, because it is people like her on whom we are relying, everybody in this room, we are relying to help beat back, to help defeat the great ideological challenge of radical Islamism. I mean, she is on the front lines. We have to reach people like that to help open their minds on these issues and issues like them, because we need them as allies. So it's not so much a type of Muslim practice, it's moderate Muslim, if that's what you're looking for, but it's how we can reach people and open their minds if they are people of goodwill, because we need them to help fight the biggest battle that we're facing right now.
Would it be fair to conclude that were the World War II to be taking place today, with the mood and attitudes of the Muslim world today, things would be rather different than they were 60 years ago?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Let me answer it first this way. On my first trip to Tunisia, I asked my first interviewee, who was a prominent historian, I asked him about what happened in Tunis on Liberation Day, the day the Allies evicted the Germans, because we all know Liberation Day, people are kissing, et cetera, et cetera. And so he looked at me with this quizzical look in his eye, and he said, he's speaking in French, but he said, Liberation Day? Excuse me, Dr. Saloff, but the Germans left and the French came back and this was Liberation Day? So it's a very difficult comparison to make, because for many people in this part of the world, they didn't mind the coming of the Germans or the coming of the enemies of Republican France, because it meant, you know, getting rid of the French. And if they put up with the Germans, it's just one colonialist after another. Today, it's obviously different. These are independent countries. They make decisions all by themselves. You can hold their rulers responsible. If the battle were fought today between the enemies of freedom and the allies of freedom, and one of them was beset on exterminating the Jews, I regrettably think that a larger percentage of Arab and Muslim societies would today be willing perpetrators than was the percentage back then. But I also think, and this is based on you know, my own 20 years of traveling, that you would still have your rescuers, you would still have your people who risked all to save some Jews.
Given everything you just said, how extreme your estimation is Ahmadinejad and the comments that he made today about Holocaust denial, and how serious it should be?
I think we should be taking this very seriously. I mean, he is the most brazenly anti-Semitic head of state since the end of World War II. And he's a head of state who is bent on the acquisition of nuclear weapons. Now, we don't have to build him up into a global superpower, because he's not. But we should take him seriously, at his word. I don't know if Daniel ascribes to this principle, but one of the principles that I derive from my study of the Middle East is, by and large, believe what people tell you. Believe them. Believe it in the sense that if they say that their strategic objective is to annihilate the state of Israel, believe it. Whether he achieves the means, whether he can be stopped, these are all issues that we can address. But I believe it. And I believe that it is an extraordinarily serious and urgent threat. And one of my great fears about American politics at the moment is, for obvious and understandable reasons, the debate about Iraq sucks so much oxygen out of our national discussion about security that we don't have enough lung power. We don't have enough strength in our lungs to talk about some of the other, and perhaps even more, serious threats that are coming down the road. I also think that we should not forget that to the Ayatollahs and to the Revolutionary Guards in Iran, Israel, of course, is the little Satan. The United States is the great Satan. We are the great Satan. We are the number one enemy. Israel is the lapdog of the great Satan. Although he has targeted his words principally at Israel, the philosophy of the Islamic Revolution has the United States as the chief enemy. And I think we should not, we cannot afford to overlook that reality.
Not only do I agree that one should pay attention to them, I've actually written an article arguing that one should pay attention to the public statements as opposed to the private ones. Tempting when someone whispers to you what he really thinks to believe that, but that's not so important. Public utterances. We have time for just one more question, and I would like to point out that Rob's books are for sale in the back of the room, and I urge you to get your copy. Last question.
You pointed out that now you were getting somewhat positive response from the Moroccan government, and that anecdotally you received positive emails, but what is the response of American Arab organizations like CARE, like the Anti-Arab American? If any segment of the Arab population needs to demonstrate that they can live in a pluralistic society, that they recognize the reality of the Holocaust, it would be Arab Americans, particularly their official organs. So have you gotten any response from them?
So far, no. And I think that fact reflects a larger reality, which is the leadership of these organizations, many of these domestic American organizations, are in many ways more closed-minded, more radical, more or less willing to reflect on their own history and their own experience than Arabs in Arab countries. I've had absolutely wonderful experiences in a broad range of Arab countries, all across the map. But my view of some of these organizations in the United States is, well, let's say it's much less generous than the view of leaders and people overseas.
So, on behalf of the Jewish Federation of Philadelphia, the Middle East Forum, and I might add the Washington Institute for Middle East Policy, and Rolf is the head of, thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Bob.